a state senator linked to an extremist group, measuring student characteristics, plus recruiting Chicago cops who won't get vaccinated, and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending October 22nd, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana State Senator Scott Baldwin has been linked to the anti-government extremist group, the Oath Keepers. ProPublica analyzed a leaked list of more than 35,000 members of the group and found about four dozen state and local government officials across the country, all of them Republicans, including Baldwin, who was reportedly listed as an annual member. Prosecutors have said Oath Keepers were part of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Indiana Senator Scott Baldwin, a former Indianapolis police officer, says he gave $30 to the group in 2010 when he was running for county sheriff. In a statement, the Hoosier Republican says the Oath Keepers were described to him then as a Second Amendment's rights group, and he says he's had no interactions or communications with it since that decade-old donation. In a statement, the Indiana Democratic Party called the reported connection alarming and says Baldwin should denounce the group. How concerning is this report about Baldwin? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Lindsay Erdody, WFYI digital editor for Health and Education. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, Baldwin said he gave $30 to the group more than 10 years ago when they were not the violent organization that they have sort of become now. Should that be the end of the story?
Well, they may not have been the violent organization they've become now, but they certainly were racist and misogynist back then. And yeah, 10 years ago, it was obviously a mistake, okay? It was a mistake to ever give to them. And, you know, if he wants to have it put in the rearview mirror, he ought to denounce the group. He ought to stand up and say, I didn't understand what they stood for. I now know what they stand for, and I am not with them, and I denounce their activities and their assault on democracy, and I don't want to have anything to do with them. And if he did that, it would be put in the rearview mirror, but, you know, interestingly enough, he hasn't done that.
Mike O'Brien, is a denunciation of the Oath Keepers something that Scott Baldwin should do?
This would be harder to defend him if he had ever put himself out there as some right-wing nut. I mean, if you look at his life before the legislature, he was a veteran, he had experience in law enforcement, he was a business owner. The priorities he's taken up as a member of the General Assembly last session, he focused on broadband investment, he focused on in-state tuition benefits for veterans, community corrections funding. Nothing about his resume or his time in public life suggests anything other than he's just a pragmatic kind of straight shooter lawmaker for a pretty moderate part of the state, too, which is embracing that. NPR did a study or did a report about 6 months ago on the Oath Keepers. And part of that report was trying to figure out how many of these people are there actually, because they claim 35 or 40,000. The report suggests that it's probably at most 5,000. You go, all right, where are the other 30,000 people? The answer is they're probably the Scott Baldwins of the world. They showed up to a Lincoln Day dinner. A firefighter put a sign-up sheet in front of his face and asked him for $30, and he did it. And that was the last time he heard about it until, you know, Tuesday. That was in 2010, and the last next time he heard about it was a couple of days ago. So I think, you know, I don't think is any different than buying a raffle ticket at church. Good luck getting off of that email list the rest of your life. So this idea that all of us who are part of party organizations, auxiliary organizations, and then we're forever beholden to everything that organization does at any time in the future, long after we were ever participating in it, is absurd and irrational.
Nobody's saying he's beholden to them or he's accountable to them, but he ought to stand up and say that they don't represent his values.
I think
and that
you're
they
beholden
are
him to it now,
that is,
right?
Excuse me?
You're beholden to it right now. I mean, you're
no. If he doesn't denounce them when he joined them, they were still racist and still misogynistic.
He's now accountable forever and ever until he satisfies you.
No, he's accountable until he denounces them and he hasn't done it.
All right. John,
exercise.
John Schwannis, I want to ask you this question, which is a denunciation really necessary? He said, I didn't really know what the organization was 10 years ago or 11 years ago. I certainly have nothing to do with them now. Isn't that enough?
Probably not if he wants to put to rest this issue. As Ann suggests, whether he's beholden to them or not, and let's assume he's not, if that it is what he describes, a contribution to an organization he didn't know much about 10 years ago, still, every move he makes in the General Assembly in the next session will be viewed against that backdrop if he doesn't denounce the organization. You know, every vote will be, there might be a line at the, if it's a crucial vote and it's makes a difference on a given topic, I could see stories, you know, in paragraph 20 mentioning that he was the fellow who wouldn't denounce Oath Keepers, having given a contribution a decade earlier. And if journalists don't, I'm sure Ann and Mike Schmuel and Democrats will do that for him. So the cleanest, clearest way to get this behind is to just denounce it. And in the meantime, it sounds as if Oath Keepers probably have an accounting, a bookkeeping issue to deal with, because they say that to be an annual member, you have to give a minimum of $30, I think it is, a year to be in good standing. So if he's that far in arrears, boy, I'm not sure what that says about their bookkeeping, but
it feels a little like bookkeeping is probably the least of the Oath Keepers' worries at this point. But Scott, Lindsay or Doty, Scott Baldwin aside, with the January 6th investigations still ongoing, with this leaked data from the organization still being sort of picked through, is this where the last we're going to hear about this organization when it comes to Indiana politics?
I think that's a good question. You know, when the ProPublica report came out and you saw, you know, the big headline that state lawmakers, all these elected officials are tied to this group, my first thought was, huh, I wonder if anyone from Indiana is connected to this group. And then turns out there are. The ProPublica story also mentioned two county commissioners in Indiana. I am not aware of who they are yet. I haven't seen it reported anywhere who they are, but it was mentioned in there. You know, and in terms of Scott Baldwin denouncing it, the other interesting thing was that in the story, some of these other lawmakers from other states and elected officials are proudly standing with them. So he is kind of, you know, walking a little bit of a different line there. And he's not going so far to denounce them, but he is also not saying, yep, I'm still a member, I'm here for them. So there's a little bit of a difference there. So, you know, if we find out other Indiana elected officials are involved, you know, it'll be interesting to see what side of that line they fall on.
Right. Well, Indiana education officials recently took the next step to revamp school accountability. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports the State Board of Education approved a list of student characteristics for the state to track as part of a new school performance dashboard.
Board members finalized a total of 5 knowledge and skill areas the dashboard will focus on. Things like students' academic progress, as well as their communication skills and work ethic. But now the state has to figure out what kind of data can measure those and help evaluate school performance. School Performance and Transformation Director Ron Sandlin says the goal isn't to minimize the importance of academic progress.
We are just elevating the importance of these complementary skill sets that we hear are valued outside of our K-12 system.
The state will seek public input on how to measure the traits, including through an online form.
Mike O'Brien, is this a worthwhile idea to start with?
Absolutely a worthwhile idea. I mean, one thing that we're seeing it with the challenges in the workforce right now. Before it was finding qualified people, now it's finding anyone at all, right? So this idea that we should understand the soft skills that kids are learning through school, where they excel and where they're sufficient, is a really important indicator for kind of their future in the workforce. It's something that employers have been asking for, making a greater investment in things that are outside of certainly, you know, math, science, you know, reading, all critical, you know, diploma track programs that need to be measured. But the skills that go around that, whether it's financial literacy that's a part of this, civic literacy, communication skills, and those other things that are really actually determine your future in life and your future odds of success in life ought to be measured and focused on as early as we can.
And Delaney, is this a good shift for the state to take, to not just look at the sort of the test scores and the grades, but to try and look at measuring those soft skills?
What is this? It's at least an annual change, okay, or at least a biannual change. Every year or every 2 years, we're changing something. We're doing ISTEP, we're doing ISTEP Plus, we're doing A through F, we're doing... It is another ridiculous attempt, frankly, on the part of those people in charge of education to ignore the problems we have. The problems we have is that even with the raises for teachers, we are still spending less on public education than any school in the Midwest. We have demeaned the profession of being a teacher over the years through the Republican Party. And the result is we have nobody signing up to be teachers. And now we want to tell them we're going to quantify the students' work ethic. Good luck with that. I mean, does that mean they show up on time? Does it mean they turn their assignments in, or they turn their assignments in with vigor? I mean, how do you measure those kinds of things? It's another ridiculous requirement that they try to lay on top of teachers who are underpaid and underappreciated. And we ought to focus more on the basis of the education. A lot of the things you're talking about, whether or not it's work ethic or whether or not it's communication skills, come through family involvement. They don't come through the classroom anyway. And the idea that they can somehow quantify these, measure them, and give them a grade is unrealistic in the extreme. And we should be focusing on those things that the legislature and the governor can deal with. And those can deal with funding and making it attractive for people to choose education as a career.
Well, we just have more faith in the public school system than you do, I guess, Anne. I think
your faith in the public school system is misplaced since you don't put the resources behind it. Put the money where your mouth is.
There's an extra $1 billion in it this year than there was last
year. That's right. And that still makes us last in the Midwest in public education funding. Dead last.
All right. Lindsay or Doty, is perhaps the biggest problem here the idea of quantifying something like work ethic or communication skills?
Yeah, I'm very interested to see how they end up measuring some of these things. I mean, these categories, when you look at them, you know, that is my first and biggest question. And what actual data can you gather that would then measure these things? And so, you know, there is certainly this effort to get away from only focusing on the standardized testing, which is clearly something that's easy to have data behind and get it. And that's probably why we've had standardized testing for so long. But the trick really is, okay, what data then backs up some of these social skills? And I'm really curious to see, you know, what public input they get over, you know, the next however long. And that's probably why they also are giving themselves so long to come up with this. You know, we're still years away from this being implemented in the schools because it is going to take time to figure out.
John Schwanis and Delaney said, you know, this is another thing that's being put on the backs of teachers to do in the classroom. I don't know whether or not in terms of the rollout of this, that will be true. I don't know if it will fall more on teachers or perhaps it will fall more on administrators. But one thing I'll note is that over the last several years, Republicans at the State House have really been concerned about the amount of the funding that they send to schools getting to the classroom versus going to administrative costs. And so they've been harping on schools to cut down on administrative costs, cut down on administrators. Can we be doing that at the same time that we're adding potentially more of an administrative burden in the form of measuring all these new things?
Well, it's the question, how do we measure it? And to whom will that responsibility fall? Will the state be in charge of some sort of standardized assessment that looks at things like work ethic and progress, or will it fall to people at individual schools or individual school districts? I presume we probably should not speak in such general terms that teachers would be monolithic in opposition to this, because in fact, if teachers and schools are graded solely as they have to this point on sort of the traditional academics for the most part. And there are kids clearly who just aren't, no matter what intervention is there, they're not going to excel in that area. Maybe they have other talents, but theoretically, at least, this would be an opportunity for them to display work ethic or to display the vigor or enthusiasm for their efforts. So it could actually be a benefit, it seems, to some teachers and to some schools. But again, the trick is trying to figure out how to assess this. You know, we can't agree how to rank colleges and rate universities. They've been fighting about that for decades. And can you imagine that actually does have data behind it in terms of research and outreach and fact quality of teaching? This is going to be a head scratcher in terms of how to come up with that data.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Icemiller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the state try to measure student characteristics besides test scores, such as communication skills and work ethic? A yes or B no. Last week's question was, will Joe Donnelly run for either Senate or governor in 2024? Just 15% of you say he'll make another run for the Senate. 41% think he'll run for governor, but 44% say neither one. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, an Indiana State Police spokesperson this week tweeted and later deleted a recruiting message aimed at Chicago police officers who left their jobs over the city's COVID-19 vaccine mandate. The Lowell State Police Post's Twitter account tweeted, "We're hiring," to Chicago police officers, touting the lack of a vaccine mandate for state police, as well as lower taxes, great schools, and welcoming communities. That tweet was deleted the next day after it received significant attention. But the message has also come from further up the government ladder. U.S. Senator Mike Braun has also been outspoken about welcoming Chicago police who refuse to get the vaccine. Chicago police and Mayor Lori Lightfoot are locked in a legal battle over the city's vaccine mandate for employees. At least 55% of police department employees are vaccinated.
Lindsay Erdody, the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy had to temporarily shut down earlier this year because of a COVID outbreak among its largely unvaccinated trainees. Are these Chicago cops the folks we want in public safety in Indiana?
Well, we know that, you know, police are out in the public on a regular basis. They're interacting with people on a regular basis. And we also know if you're unvaccinated, you are much more likely to catch COVID-19. You are much more likely to spread the virus to others. And that seems like something we wouldn't want in our public safety. And if you think about it from a employer perspective too, unvaccinated individuals are more likely, like I said, to catch the virus, to then spread it to others. So they're going to be out sick. That would cause other police officers to have to quarantine and be out sick. And if you're already short staffed, that also seems like not the best strategy in terms of, you know, making sure you have a full force that can go out and protect and serve.
Ann Delaney, the fact that this tweet was deleted, whether through the officer himself or through orders from above, would that suggest to you what the state police's position is on this recruiting effort, if you will?
Well, or somebody's position on it. I mean, it was ridiculous, as was Mike Braun's position. I mean, he's the one that's been railing for years against the benefits and the pay given to public employees in Illinois. Is he going to match them if they come to Indiana? Is he going to drive Indiana into the red so that they can fund these public pensions that he's complained about for years? Lindsay is that exactly right. I mean, if these officers are not responsible enough and not interested in protecting the public enough to be vaccinated, they ought to be fired. And we don't want them. And we don't want Mike Braun stirring the pot in Chicago just so he can make some political points, because that's all he's doing.
Mike O'Brien, no government entity in Indiana, according to state law, can impose a vaccine mandate. That was something the legislature did this year. But aren't public safety officials the sort of folks that probably should be vaccinated?
Yeah, I think they should be. I mean, I think the fact the tweet was deleted for any reason suggests the obviously the position of the state police as a state agency is the same as the position of the governor and the State Department of Health. And they've not been shy about encouraging and actively invested resources and put public resources and people on the ground to go make sure that people know that they should encourage them to get vaccinated. So this seems like kind of like a too cute by half way to adapt what has been a very effective message in Illinois on, from an economic development standpoint, that Indiana is hiring and they should move over here, which has been very effective, particularly in Northwest Indiana. And it was adapted for this purpose, which was entirely inappropriate. And certainly contrary again to what the actions have been of Governor Holcomb now for 18 months to encourage, or at least last year, to encourage people to get vaccinated. And the amount of time and effort that has been put into that really makes a comment like this, pretty offensive to that effort.
All right. Well, Indiana State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box is trying a new method of communicating with the public this week, Twitter. The State Health Department has long had a Twitter account that it uses to promote public health messages, but now Dr. Box has an account on the social media platform. Box's account seems tied in part to the governor's new public health commission, created earlier this year to develop recommendations meant to strengthen the state's public health system. Box's first tweet pledged to update Hoosiers about the commission, the state of health in Indiana, and more. It's not clear whether the account is run primarily by Box or by staff, which is often the case with government officials. John Schwanis, I know some people will be wondering why I wanted to talk about this on the show, and I'm not going to pretend it's the most pressing issue that we are facing in the world, but I want to start by asking this question. What value does Dr. Box joining Twitter have?
Well, it's a means of communicating with a lot of people who rely on Twitter as their primary information source. Things have changed dramatically over the past few decades in terms of information dissemination, and with the new commission, it makes sense. However, usually when these kinds of things happen and somebody who is a state or public employee at any level decides to step out from the sort of the veil of the agency and to do his or her own thing, it's oftentimes because that person's interested in increasing his or her profile personally, perhaps for an office, a bid for office. I don't think that's the case here. Probably couldn't afford the pay cut with any other state office. So I assume if that's normally I think that, but in this case, it may just be what it purports to be.
Lindsay or Doty, I'm sure you've seen this too. Over the course of the pandemic, perhaps the most public face in Indiana around the pandemic, besides Governor Holcomb, has been Dr. Box. And as a result, I'm not sure I've seen more vitriol and, quite frankly, hate spewed online at anyone other than Governor Holcomb than they have at Dr. Box, in part because she's a woman. So I'll put it this way, whether it's Dr. Box running this Twitter account or a staffer or a combination thereof, is it worth it to do this considering what they are likely to face?
To me, that is the ultimate question, right? I mean, because to John's point, yes, like it reaches people where they are, right? It gets information out there. But I was looking at it, and at least, as of now, and it's still a new account, right? But she's got less than 2,000 followers on there. And the state health department is already on Twitter and has been on Twitter for quite some time and has about 38,000 followers. So in terms of putting information out there, they are doing that, and they're reaching a much bigger audience than her putting herself on there. I mean, Brandon, you're exactly right. Like, she has taken a lot of criticism over the course of the pandemic, and she's already getting that on that Twitter account. I mean, any public official will get that on any sort of social media platform, right? But given, that we are still in the pandemic, she is still kind of like the public face of all of it for the state, other than Governor Holcomb. This is just another avenue for people to, really come after her if they want to.
Yeah, and Delaney, to that point, quite frankly, is it worth it?
Well, I think it's pretty courageous on her part, frankly. There are the haters that are out there that don't want the mask, that don't believe in COVID, that don't believe that the earth is round. I mean, they're all out there, and she's trying to advance a message that's based on science, and she's swimming upstream in Indiana. I mean, when they had the commission hearing the other day, you listen to the litany of things that we're last in. I mean, we're 48th in funding, we're the bottom 10 in COVID response, we have more diabetes, we have more health issues than many other states other than the Deep South, and what she's trying to do is swim upstream against that And I think she deserves some credit for that.
All right. Well, finally, and I promise there's going to be an Indiana connection to this. The Chicago Sky won their first WNBA title this week, led by hometown heroes Candace Parker and Allie Quigley, Finals MVP Kalia Copper, the greatest point guard of all time, Courtney Vandersloot, Azaree Stevens, Diamond of Shields, gold medalist Steph Dolson, and Dana Evans, a proud daughter of Gary, Indiana, who was also named to the WNBA's all-rookie team this year. And that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody, WFYI Digital Editor for Health and Education. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please get vaccinated if you can, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.